Well, friends, thanks so much for joining us. He's one of the people who inspires us. When I think of James Corbett, one word comes immediately to mind: prolific. He's an investigative journalist, documentary filmmaker, writer, podcast host, and one of the most intelligent, consistent, informed, and unshakable voices in the alt-truth media space. His website is The Corbett Report, corbettreport.com. His YouTube channel is also called The Corbett Report and has more than 80,000 subscribers with more than 19 million video views. He produces the eye-opener for Sybil Edmonds' site, boilingfrogspost.com. He's the co-host of New World Next Week with James Evan Plato, and he's a regular writer and contributor to the International Forecaster, our good friend Bob Chapman's publication. He's also the talented video storyteller who brought us perhaps the single best 5 minutes of truth about the events of 9/11 with his simply perfect video titled 9/11, A Conspiracy Theory, which has now been seen by more than 2.3 million people so far. It's my absolute pleasure to welcome James Corbett.
Well, hi, Sean. Thank you so much for having me on. I appreciate you and the work you're doing as well.
Well, it's a real thrill. I got to tell you, we hear names like Jeremy Scahill and Glenn Greenwald and Matt Taibbi a lot. We should hear your name more in the regular media sphere, because I don't think that there's anybody who is quite as prolific as you. And I have to ask you, where in the world did you find time on top of everything else to create this new documentary, Century of Enslavement, The History of the Federal Reserve?
Well, that's a good question, and I'll let you know when I figure it out myself. Perhaps the most baffling part of all of this is that I believed I was going to be able to do this in 1 month. Of course, it ended up taking me 7 months in order to put it out, so perhaps even I am not quite as much of a miracle worker as I like to believe.
Well, it's a stunning recap of what humanity is up against, and the good news is there are many of us from all different walks of life that are waking up, so we can talk about your documentary. One of the things I did want to talk about, though, is your piece, 9/11, A Conspiracy Theory. And, for those who haven't heard it or seen it yet, it's 5 minutes long. You can find it on James's YouTube site, Corbett Report. Just search YouTube, Corbett Report, and that's two T's, C-O-R-B-E-T-T, Report. And you got to Google this, 9/11, A Conspiracy Theory. Let's listen just to the first portion.
On the morning of September 11th, 2001, 19 men armed with box cutters directed by a man on dialysis in a cave fortress halfway around the world using a satellite phone and a laptop directed the most sophisticated penetration of the most heavily defended airspace in the world, overpowering the passengers and the military combat trained pilots on 4 commercial aircraft before flying those planes wildly off course for over an hour without being molested by a single fighter interceptor. These 19 hijackers, devout religious fundamentalists who like to drink alcohol, snort cocaine, and live with pink-haired strippers, managed to knock down 3 buildings with 2 planes in New York. While in Washington, a pilot who couldn't handle a single-engine Cessna was able to fly a 757 in an 8,000-foot descending 270-degree corkscrew turn to come exactly level with the ground, hitting the Pentagon in the budget analyst office where DOD staffers were working on the mystery of the $2.3 trillion that Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld had announced missing from the Pentagon's coffers in a press conference the day before, on September 10th.
It leaves you breathless. It is just so perfectly written and perfectly crafted, James. How did you manage to pull that one off? It's a home run.
Well, thank you for that, and I've certainly heard that from a lot of people over the past few years. Basically, that was intended as an inside joke for the 9/11 truth community, so I was staggered when it became a viral video and took off with the general public, because really what this is a condensation of, at that point, I believe my 5 or 6 years of research into 9/11 truth into as compact a space as I possibly could. And of course, the point of the entire video is simply that the official story, the official conspiracy theory of these 19 men conspiring with Osama bin Laden is so ridiculous that it parodies itself. I mean, just telling the story that they actually want us to believe is so ludicrous that it's funny. It's actually funny to just listen to this story. And that was really the whole point and genesis of that. And it was an idea that occurred to me probably a few weeks before I actually put the video out. And I was just knocking it around in my head. I had the first few lines just sort of stuck in my head, and I was just repeating them and trying to get into the sense of that voice. And then it all came in a rush. I think I wrote and made the video in one day, I believe. And that was just me sitting at home in my pajamas on the 10th anniversary of 9/11, which was when it was released. So it staggers me that caught on with the general public, but I'm glad that it did.
Well, it's a masterwork, and what leaves me speechless about it is that it's been seen on your YouTube channel alone 2.235 million times, and I know that other YouTube channels have taken it and posted it as well, and it's just a wonderful precursor or primer for those who are now beginning to wake up and question this new world order, essentially, for lack of a better phrase, but these powers that are in control of our government, these central banking powers, which you're going to talk about. This is such a wonderful primer for those people who then might be inspired to dig deeper into the work of David Ray Griffin, Stephen Jones, AE 9/11 Truth, Kevin Ryan and his top 10 connections between NIST and nanothermites. Obviously, you and I know, and the listeners know, that the rabbit hole goes far, far, far deeper than you could possibly encompass in this 5 minutes, but I just can't believe it's been 13 years since 9/11 and 3 years since you made this great microdoc.
Well, thank you. Yeah, no, I can't really believe that either. I mean, it doesn't seem like that much time has elapsed since 9/11 actually occurred. It seems like the blink of an eye. And yet, from the other perspective, it staggers me to think there's an entire generation of young people who are growing up right now who really haven't known anything other than this war on terror, police state mentality that the United States and really much of the world was plunged into as a consequence of 9/11. So it is extremely important to let that generation, and of course every other generation, know that at base what we are being asked to swallow with this story is itself a self-evident, ridiculous lie. And I think the best way to expose that really is to laugh at it. There are many ways to treat a tyrant, but the one thing they really can't stand is to be made fun of. And I think, honestly, the Emperor's New Clothes story is really a story about laughing at the Emperor rather than be cowering in fear at him. And I think that's the way we have to treat the current situation and the powers that shouldn't be, who really do want to use the events of 9/11 to continue. I mean, they will continue to parade on the graves of those people who died that day, as long as that agenda continues to serve their interests. And I think that, again, the best way to counteract that is simply laughing at them and their ridiculous story and letting them know that a vast number of people in the public and a growing number just simply won't buy into their propaganda.
Well, it's astounding, too, as we approach September 11th, being less than a month away, it's astounding that literally everybody in media, I mean, you can pick your favorite media outlet. If it's a mainstream Mockingbird media outlet, it doesn't matter where it is. It could be Fox News. It could be CNN. It could be MSNBC. It could be the Wall Street Journal. It could be the New York Times. It could be Time Magazine. It could be whatever it is that you think is great, Huffington Post. They will continue to malign those of us with critical thinking skills who question the official story of 9/11. Like we are tinfoil hat wearing nuts, which is astounding, especially when you know the CIA itself rolled out a plan after the JFK assassination to malign those that would dare to ask questions and bring up ideas like conspiracy theories. It's all a plan. It's a plan to circumvent justice and truth, and your documentary helps open eyes. But don't you find it astounding that they can still get away with maligning those of us that would dare question the official story?
I don't really find that surprising in the least, to tell you the truth. And just for those who are interested, the document you're referring to there is CIA document 1035-960. Just type that into a search engine and you can read the document that was released in 1967 as the public was beginning to become more skeptical of the official findings of the Warren Commission. And they were talking in that document about the fact that these conspiracy theories continue to be propounded and we have to try to connect them to communist forces that are trying to sow the seeds of doubt in the American public and things of that nature. The CIA openly talking about how to use these terms like conspiracy theory against the people who would question their official narrative. And of course, it was very much the CIA's official narrative with Dulles, Alan Dulles, of course, one of the main people who would be seen as a suspect in the JFK assassination, having been on that Warren Commission that, of course, found Lee Harvey Oswald as lone nut. So it is an exceptionally effective term. It has been since it was coined and parroted out through the Mockingbird media, which is why I do not find it surprising in the least that even though, for example, I mean, 80 to 90% of the public, depending on the polls that you look at, no longer believe in the lone nut Lee Harvey Oswald theory in the JFK assassination, still they will continue to act as if it is absolutely monolithic, unquestionable truth that he was the lone assassin. So that doesn't surprise me in the least. The thing that I'm much more disappointed in is the fact that there is still still a large contingent in the alternative or the so-called alternative media, including some of those names that you mentioned earlier, who will not at all ever go anywhere near towards questioning, fundamentally questioning the events of 9/11, because I think, I assume, because these people want to become part of that mainstream system and want to be taken seriously in the mainstream. So they pander and they refuse to go into these areas. And that's very much to the detriment of the alt media generally, because unfortunately it creates, it fosters a mindset amongst people who I think would otherwise be inclined towards questioning these events, who won't do so because they don't see their so-called heroes doing so. And I find that much more disappointing than the corporate media just doing what the corporate media does.
Yeah, I do too. And the same goes for Amy Goodwin there over at PBS.
Democracy Now, yeah.
Yeah, Democracy Now. I mean, I do respect a lot of their work and admire a lot of their interviews. But, you know, they tend not to go after the 9/11 truth either. And she was there that day. She was blocks away from World Trade Center 7 as it came down. You can see her in video as that building collapses. If anybody should have been reporting about it, it should be Amy. But I digress. You know what? Here's the bottom line of what we're talking about, folks. If you want to understand how we got where we've gotten, if you want to understand the dire situation under which humanity now finds itself, you need to understand central banking. And James, your epic feature-length documentary film exposes the men behind the curtain and the system of financial enslavement and control which they wield and have wielded over Americans since 1913. You and I know it goes back a couple hundred years even before that, which you cover in your documentary. This system really is the belly of the beast, and one can't be fully awake until one understands it, can they?
I certainly don't think so, and that's obviously what motivated me to create this documentary. It's called Century of Enslavement, The History of the Federal Reserve, which is something of a contentious title, I realize, but I really do feel strongly that debt is a modern form of slavery, and a very insidious one, because it's easy to see a situation where there's a master with a whip making people physically do something, to see that as a master-slave relationship. It is much more difficult to see men and women these days in suits with, you know, 1,000-watt smiles telling the cameras all of the lies in press conferences at Jackson Hole and other prestigious conferences around the world. The central bankers who are very much enslaving the world through the debt creation system that they've pioneered, but it's much more difficult to identify that and put our finger on it. So I hope this documentary goes some way towards identifying that problem and really identifying what the root of this problem is, so that we can at least start to open the conversation towards solutions and how we can really wean ourselves off of this this corrupt system.
Yeah, and I know that you guys listening know about the work of G. Edward Griffin and the creature from Jekyll Island. I've interviewed G. Edward Griffin. G. Edward Griffin appears in your documentary, James. But you really do go extremely deep into this, and it's just a great review of the history that most people do not know. Most Americans have no idea. And you say in the documentary, and I loosely quote, "We are taught that economics is boring, but the truth is that the story of the secret banking conclave that gave birth to the Federal Reserve Act is as exciting as any Hollywood screenplay, and all the more remarkable because it's all true." And I just think it's fascinating for everybody to just reposition their understanding of history through the lens of facts, right? Because you note in the documentary that on November 22nd, 1910, in the private rail car that belonged to Senator Aldrich, the father-in-law to billionaire John D. Rockefeller, in attendance were A. Piatt Andrew, the assistant treasury secretary. Right there, we can holler out treason, can't we, James? Can I just stop right there and say treason? Why was the assistant treasury secretary A. Piatt Andrew on board that train on the way to Jekyll Island?
Why was Senator Aldrich, and why were the two of them there with all of the conclave of banksters who at the time were openly called the Money Trust and were openly reviled by the public? Of course, the 1910 meeting occurred in the wake of the panic of 1907, which was the financial panic that really shook Wall Street to its very core and threatened and actually did take under some of the largest institutions on Wall Street at that time, including the Knickerbocker Trust Company. So it was a time in which people were very much concerned about the monetary stability of the United States, of the dollar, and there was a great outcry when the commission that was set up in the immediate wake of the Panic of 1907 discovered that, in fact, there were three banks that basically controlled the economy of the United States. And, of course, the public found that to be an unacceptable position. They were already very nervous and wary about the influence that people like J.P. Morgan wielded over the economy. And so in the wake of that, in the midst of that, as the public are crying out for some type of solution, here you have Senator Aldrich, as you say, the father-in-law of John D. Rockefeller Jr., and A. Piatt Andrew, the Treasury Secretary, meeting with Benjamin Strong and Henry P. Davison and Frank Vanderlip and Paul Warburg, some of the most important and influential bankers in the United States at that time, meeting completely in secret over the course of 2 weeks there in late November, early December of 1910 on Jekyll Island, just off the coast of Georgia. And this is a remarkable story because it is a conspiracy. It is an actual, true, documented, admitted 100% conspiracy that was the genesis of what became the Federal Reserve. And again, we don't have to go out on a branch to talk about that. We can turn to Frank Vanderlip himself, one of the conspirators at the meeting, who ended up writing all about it in 25 years later in the Saturday Evening Post, in an article that is actually linked up in the transcript for this documentary on my website. And it's an absolutely admitted open conspiracy that took place, where the bankers, who themselves were the ones that the public were trying to chain down with the creation of a central bank, were the ones creating that central bank. And that is such a basic ruse, such a basic point that should be taught, obviously, in any competent history course that's really trying to talk about the history of the United States and how the monetary system has come about. But of course, that basic point is completely and utterly ignored by the mainstream, to the point where you had recently a discussion on Bloomberg involving various panelists, one of which asserted that there's a lot of conspiracy theories about the Federal Reserve, without noting that the Federal Reserve itself was the result of conspiracy. Again, it's quite remarkable when you take a look at the history, rather than simply accept what's written down in the average history textbook.
That's right. And I always like to remind people, James, that, you know, when you hear names like Warren Buffett and Bill Gates bandied about as being among the world's richest men, you have to chuckle. When you know real history, you know about multi-generational banking wealth. And Jekyll Island was the home to the prestigious Jekyll Island Club, which included members like the Morgans, the Rockefellers, Warburgs, and Rothschilds. Now, therein lies the rub. If you want to know what humanity is up against, the money powers, the central banking powers, the private individual families that own and control central banks, you got to take a look at those families, right? The Rothschilds, the Rockefellers, Warburgs, the Morgans, J.P. Morgan, really the heart of so much trouble on Wall Street even today. And in your documentary, you note that 1913 and the establishment of the Federal Reserve was just the beginning, really, of the pain, as you and I know it now, you know, 100 years later. But the pain goes back nearly 200 years earlier to the formation of the Bank of England.
In fact, more than that, it was 1694 that the Bank of England was formally chartered, and it came about as the result of a proposal by a Scottish banker named William Paterson. Basically, King William III was embroiled in the Nine Years' War with France, and at that time, France had won a devastating naval victory over the English Navy. And King William III was looking to rebuild the Navy and didn't have the funds to do so. So he took up William Paterson's idea to form a bank that would be given the right of note issue and in return for a £1.2 million loan to the government. And that's exactly what took place. So out of the charter that William granted this bank, King William, the bank was able to create the loan that it then loaned to the government, mostly out of thin air. There was some capital that was provided to start the bank, obviously, but at that point, it then used its charter to create the money that it then loaned to the government at interest, of course, 8% interest, and it also got the right of note issue, so it could issue its own currency. That was a pretty remarkable feat for the banking interests that were behind that that idea, and unfortunately, that became a template that was continued and implemented in country after country around the globe, including, of course, the United States, where it was transported less than 100 years later towards the creation of America's first central bank, and one that most Americans, again, probably know very little about, the Bank of North America.
I just think that everybody needs to do themselves a favor, and they need to check out this fantastic documentary, Century of Enslavement, The History of the Federal Reserve. And for God's sake, if you like James as much as I do, and I know you all do, go over to his website at CorbettReport.com and buy a DVD. Buy 10 DVDs. Hand them out to your friends and your family. James, can you just explain to people how they might be able to get to your site? What should they buy? I know you have all sorts of alternatives there with this DVD.
Well, the first thing that I should stress is that the documentary is 100% completely freely available online on YouTube, on my website. The best place to go to watch the documentary is CorbettReport.com/Federal Reserve. And if you go there, you can find the documentary on YouTube. You can find the transcript, the hyperlinked transcript with links to everything that I talk about in the documentary. There's a little flyer that you can print off if you want to help spread the word about this documentary. And of course, you can also purchase a DVD. Again, that is just a way of supporting this work. It's a two DVD set. The first DVD contains the documentary itself. The second DVD contains my full 1 hour interview with J. Edward Griffin that I conducted back last December. And it runs 2,000 Japanese yen, which is about 20 American dollars, 20 Federal Reserve notes, and is the juice that I use to create the media that I'm continuing to put out at Corbett Report. Obviously, people's support is genuinely appreciated in the monetary sense, but there are many, many other ways that you can help besides. Of course, I'm always looking for translation help for the documentary, if people can translate it into other languages, even if just people want to take it and send it out to their email list or however people want to spread the word about this. Every little bit helps, because again, this is really just intended not only hopefully primarily as an introduction of to the Federal Reserve and why it must be resisted by the general public, but also as I hope as a tool for people who already have an understanding that there is something wrong with the Federal Reserve to have a better understanding specifically what is wrong, where that history comes from, specifically what the Federal Reserve itself says about its own operations and why it itself basically has identified its own problems if you look deeply enough. So again, that's all contained in the documentary. You can purchase a DVD if you want to support the work. And just for SGT Report listeners, if you type in the coupon code SGT10 when you're purchasing the DVD, you can get a 10% discount.
Thanks, James. And if it's okay with you, I want to transition now back to the present, because everybody appreciates your analysis and your intellect so much. I think we absolutely have to at least talk briefly about current events. But I want to say that at 1:19:35, an hour and 19 minutes into your documentary, I got goosebumps. And the good news is this. The goosebumps came from the End the Fed chants, you know, at Occupy, in a big arena at a Ron Paul event. And there's an awakening happening, and that's the good news, because I always like to say, James, that the men behind the curtain have been revealed. Once you know the truth, you can't unknow it, and that's the beautiful thing about what's happening. And thanks to the internet, thanks to me being able to meet and talk to guys like you and understand your work and learn from it, and thanks to everybody who's really getting involved in truth media by spreading links, sharing information, spreading your 9/11 conspiracy theory documentary. By doing these things and talking about these things, the world is waking up. There's the formation of the BRICS Bank. There's this acknowledgement that all wars are bankers' wars. Max Kaiser just recently said on his recent Kaiser Report, if peace were to break out, stock markets around the world would crash. And he's right. This is a war-based, insane economy based on debt and death, as my friend Chris Duane likes to say, and people have had enough. And I think, you know, with the formation of the BRICS Bank and the de-dollarization happening between China, Russia, and India and these others, Brazil, we can see that nation states are fed up. What's your take on anything I've just said there?
I completely agree with you, and I just want to say I'm so glad to hear that feedback that you got goosebumps specifically at that particular point, because that has struck me for a number of years as being truly a goosebump-worthy moment, and I have shared that response. When you see tens of thousands of people gathered together chanting "End the Fed," understanding what the Federal Reserve is and the danger that it really represents and the fact that it must be eliminated, that is a truly revolutionary moment, or at least potentially a truly revolutionary moment. Of course, that can be diverted away, or that can be steered down blind alleys, but I think that at least the idea of having a public that once again is truly motivated by the monetary issue and about the central banking issue, that to me is something that it speaks of a really remarkable revolutionary moment. So I was hoping to be able to capture something of that in this documentary and let people understand just how remarkable this is. But I think you're right. Again, it is a system based on debt and death, and it is a system that more people are waking up to and more people are rejecting. That is happening at the international level, as you say, with the creation of the BRICS Development Bank, all of the bilateral trade agreements that China and Russia and others are signing right now in local currencies, the de-dollarization that's happening. But I think that there's also this is part of a dialectic. And on one side of the dialectic, we have the big bad American empire and everything that it's become in terms of spreading its debt and death around the world at the point of a gun. And on the other side of that dialectic, we have the emerging BRICS powers and their allies that are basically in this dialectic posited, well, these are the good side. These are the good guys that are going to use their influence and their local currencies for good. But I think it still maintains the fundamental structure that is the problem in the first place. It maintains these currencies that are created by these central banks that are maintained and manipulated by banksters. And even if these developing countries' banksters are good people and they mean well and they're angels descended from heaven to bring happiness and peace and sunshine to the world, that doesn't mean that 10 years from now, 20 years from now, a generation from now, it couldn't turn into exactly what the Federal Reserve is today, the evil empire. And that, I think, is the real danger here, that people can be lulled into a false sense of security by these counter-globalization, but alternative globalization forces. So the BRICS, we can put all of our eggs in the BRICS basket instead of in the American empire basket. But at the end of the day, it amounts to the same thing. So I think that the real true revolutionary idea, the real true power, comes from people organizing in ways that unleashes the true potential of individuals acting together in communities to really unlock their own potential in terms of the labor that everyone has to offer on some level. And there are lots of different ways of doing this. I highlight a few of them in the documentary. There's mutual credit systems and things of that nature that, of course, are in most cities around the United States. You just have to look hard enough, and there's usually some type of mutual credit system, some let system or something of that nature. I highlight the Ithaca Hours system in Ithaca, New York. Mm-hmm. Another idea that I'm very, very enamored with is self-issued credit, which is an idea that's been propounded by Paul Grignon of the Money as Debt series of documentary films. It's a rather intricate idea, but basically the underlying idea is that, yes, a credit economy, it makes sense because it can expand or contract the money supply depending on basically the productive needs of that society, which is a good thing. But why on earth do we go cap in hand to the banksters to ask them to give us a loan that is created out of not just nothing, but created on the back of our promise to repay the banks?
Right.
Well, if our promise to repay the banks is good enough for the creation of that money, then it's good enough for the creation without the banks themselves being the middleman. And that idea that we can actually become self-issued, we can actually self-issue credit, is a truly revolutionary one that really does have the promise of unleashing the true productive potential of humanity in a system that isn't based on debt and debt servitude and slaving away your life to pay back a debt that you created by the magic of the bank's charter, but through an economy that relies on productive activity and promises to pay to ultimately deliver on goods and services that you can actually perform yourself. And it's a slight change in perspective that creates an entirely different system. So for people who haven't heard about self-issued credit, I really hope that they'll take a look at that. Paul Grignon has some videos on that up on his site. I've done some work on it in the past. It's a truly exciting one. But I think the point that I'm trying to stress in my documentary is that there is not just one silver bullet. There is not just one thing that we can do. I think there's many, many, many things that we can do to really unhook ourselves from the Federal Reserve System. And they're complementary. They don't have to be competitive. Well, I think they should compete with each other, but they don't have to be exclusive. I think that there will ever be one system that will be the system for conducting transactions online with people halfway around the world that I'll never see, and people in my local community, and people and retail stores that may be national in scope, and things of that nature. These are all different types of transactions. There are different functions of money. They don't all have to be done by the exact same currency. So I think that there should be an open market, a free market in currencies, and they should be allowed to compete with each other in a complementary way. And I think that that's truly the ultimate solution here, and something that I'm hoping to propound as, again, as the way of opening this conversation up, because at this point, people's imagination are limited by the system they're living in. And when our imaginations are limited, we can be steered into that false choice. Do we want the BRICS style of globalization, central bank fiat funny money, or do we want the Federal Reserve style? Well, I'm here to say that no, it isn't a choice, but either or. There's many, many other options on the table. So let's open them that menu up and start to order from it.
Hey guys, thanks so much for listening to part one of my interview with James Corbett. Stay tuned for part two, in which we talk about de-dollarization, MH17, Ebola, and the police state, which has made itself evident in Ferguson. And visit sgtreport.com daily for real news 24/7. And thank you for caring. Hey guys, this is part two of my interview with James Corbett. In the second half of the interview, we talk about MH17, de-dollarization, Ebola, and the police state, which has made itself evident in Ferguson.
Do we want the BRICS style of globalization, central bank fiat funny money, or do we want the Federal Reserve style? Well, I'm here to say that no, it isn't a choice, but either or. There's many, many other options on the table. So let's open them that menu up and start to order from it.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. We need to defund this vampire, which is so maniacal. And I guess in the time that we have left with you, James, I just want to talk about how maniacal and diabolical they are. And when I say they, I mean the intelligence agencies and the banks and the banksters, and you know the ties between the CIA and the banksters. I want to just throw out a couple of current events and get your thoughts on them. What do you make of MH17 and what we see happening there with Kiev versus Putin?
Well, I think the most interesting aspect of MH17 is that it has completely disappeared from the news radar, which at any rate, no matter what really occurred there or how it really occurred, shows that whatever they were planning to use it for propagandistically did not pan out. And that, I think, is telling in and of itself. Yeah. Obviously, this was an event that was going to be used to try to demonize Putin and potentially to force the situation in Ukraine to a head. But it did not have that effect. And I think that's ultimately because the evidence that they have attempted to corral to muster to muster public opinion on their side just simply fell flat on its face. And
the evidence they did not produce.
Exactly. Yeah. It ultimately amounted to some social media posts by various people, which is, I mean, on its face, ridiculous. And it's part of this same fantasy land that we're being increasingly asked to live in which you have an agency like the NSA or the CIA or these various intelligence agencies that, of course, have the ability to track anyone and everything that's happening on the face of the planet. But, you know, entire airplanes can go missing, as in the case of MH370, or airplanes can be shot down in the case of MH17. And no one really knows what happened. And there can be no evidence produced on any of these things. Again, I think it's this type of fantasy land that we're being asked to live in. And MH17 is a good example of that. And in fact, I have had an open source investigation on MH17 on the Corbett Report website for the last few weeks, and people have been contributing. We have a couple of hundred comments, hundreds and hundreds of links to various articles and things. I'm going to be compiling that and compressing it down and releasing a podcast on that in the next couple of weeks, so people can stay tuned to try to find out where that story ultimately ended up and where it's likely to go from here.
Yeah, I just think it's shocking that the powers that be in this country would so blatantly tried to pin this on Putin without any evidence, essentially. And then on the Russian side, they tried to be very forthcoming. I just think from a global perspective, especially if you're outside this country, it made our leaders in this country look very, very foolish. And I think it's all becoming so transparent. It reminds me of the war drums to topple Assad, you know, to go into Syria. And after Obama did his plea on TV to the American people, 90% of the American people were like, you want to go into war again? Where? Why? With my kids? Hell no. And I just think that the playbook that these guys keep going back to time and time and time and time again is worn out. It's tired. We can all, even if you're not fully awake and don't understand how the Federal Reserve works and what it is, people are starting to see the emperor has no clothes.
Yeah. Well, yeah, absolutely. And it is head scratching that they have attempted to use the Syrian Red Line or MH17 in this propagandistic way, despite having almost nothing to back it up, especially in a post-Iraq world where obviously the first and foremost thing on everyone's mind is the fact that we were completely lied to about the run-up to the Iraq war. This is not in dispute anymore. Everyone understands how that happened. So the hubris involved with thinking that they can get away with continuing those types of lies is just ridiculous. But I perhaps this is my conspiratorial mind speaking, but I think we are in the age where we have seen the zenith of the American empire and we are seeing the beginning of the decline. And I think that these are reflections of that. The fact that the American military/industrial might that, of course, is really the banking might that really is the president. I mean, they own and control him. Can't really direct the narrative on things like these anymore is clearly a sign that there has been an incredible lack in or an incredible decline in the power that America is able to assert, a decline in its political capital on the international stage. And I think that this is, at this point, part of a long-term agenda. Again, I think it's important to understand that the banking powers are absolutely not committed to the United States. They have no patriotism to this country. And, of course, a lot of them are not American in the first place, so why would they be? And this is an important point for people to understand. Just because the United States has been a serviceable host for these banksters for the last several generations does not mean that it will continue to be so. And when and if it becomes time to abandon that ship, as it increasingly looks that it is, America will be left high and dry and will be left to suffer the consequences of the things that have been done in the name of the American people. And of course, not with the active support and encouragement of the American people, but it's been done in their name. So they will suffer the consequences of that in every possible way, the economic ramifications, the military ramifications. And I think that this is the beginning of that downwards slope. And I think that's something that the American public should be very concerned with. And that's why they need to distance themselves from that banking vampire system as much as possible right now, so that it is very clear that this banking system and the military system that it owns and controls is not associated with the American public.
Yeah, just a couple more questions for you about current events, being that you're in Japan and I'm here in the United States, and I just really value your opinion here. But you used one of my favorite words, and it's hubris. The hubris of these people is absolutely stunning. And I guess at the end of the day, that's what gets me, is their hubris. And take, for instance, the hubris of the CDC. What do you take of them bringing in two Ebola patients to this country? I find it stunning because, you know, if they wanted to study Ebola and test those patients, if they were so benevolent and cared so much for those patients, they could have flown down there, which they did, incidentally, to pick them up, but they could have stayed there and treated them. Do you find it absolutely stunning that they would have imported Ebola into the United States?
It certainly makes no sense from any perspective that one can imagine, except for the perspective that this is a precedent-setting event. And I don't think that this was done to as part of some plan to spread Ebola in the United States or anything of that sort. But I think the precedent now has been set that when there is this type of pandemic outbreak anywhere in the world, well, of course, we're going to fly the Americans back home to treat them in Atlanta or wherever else is deemed fit. And it's interesting the way that the protocols for dealing with this exact type of situation have changed from 2002, where, as I noted in my most recent podcast, the U.S. AMRID, of course, the biological weapons research arm of the Department of Defense, back in 2002, the U.S. AMRID protocol officer was talking in a publication about the protocols that they have in place for dealing with people suffering from Ebola or other types of extremely contagious diseases. And at that time, they were talking about how this would be handled by the military, and it would be handled in BSL-4 facilities, biosafety level 4 facilities. And now fast forward 12 years, and suddenly this is under the purview of the Center for Disease Creation, right. I mean control, mm-hmm. Who have created this isolation ward at Emory University Hospital, which does not, from what I can understand, what I can tell, and I think details of this are being kept deliberately sketchy, but certainly does not appear to be a BSL-4 type facility, right. Where the patients are separated from the public by a thin glass partition and nothing else.
Yeah, I think it's level 2 at best.
Exactly. I mean, if you look at an actual level 4 facility, and again, that's linked up in the Ebola Panic or Pandemic article I have up on the front page of CorporateReport.com right now. If you look at some of the pictures of a BSL-4, it's clearly not the university hospital type environment. This is more like a military research type facility. So absolutely, they've changed the protocols. They've established a precedent here. I think there's a lot of precedents that get set during these times of supposed panic. And again, for people in the United States, I really don't think you should be panicked about Ebola at this particular time, considering it has not spread person to person in any other country except for those West African countries where the outbreak occurred. So I think a lot of hype and panic and fear is being instilled in the public right now as a way of justifying the really incredible and precedent-setting things that are happening right now. And as you say, I think, again, there is a bit of hubris that's going on that perhaps is catching up with the CDC, as they've had to admit a number of really embarrassing mistakes in recent months, including not only mishandling of some anthrax samples, but now they've just come out in the past few days to admit that, oops, one of our researchers accidentally mixed a very deadly live bird flu strain with a weaker strain and lied and covered up about that mistake for several weeks before we finally had to admit it. So
reminds me again, of Baxter International a few years ago, just accidentally put deadly bird flu in a vaccine and shipped it all over the planet.
And there was also, I believe it was Sanofi, I'll have to look that up, but it was experimenting with a bird flu vaccine on homeless people in Poland, and a lot of them ended up dying because it turned out to be a real strain of bird flu that killed them. So again, these types of things are happening with disturbing frequency, right. In this day and age. And that combined with all of the cultural conditioning that's going on towards contagion and the idea of outbreaks, which are being increasingly inserted into Hollywood productions and television shows.
Right, and getting the vaccine. Go out and get the vaccine. That's what I'm afraid of. And I don't mean to interrupt, but I do want to ask you this before I forget, and forgive me because I don't have the document in front of me, but we posted something not too long ago at SGT Report. It was a patent document showing that the U.S. government through the CDC has a patent on human Ebola. Have you seen that, or does that shock you, or what's your take
yes,
on that?
Yes, in fact, I do talk about this in my recent podcast. It's called The Ebola Effect, so you can search that on YouTube, or you can look at my website under podcasts, and we do talk about that. The CDC has been patenting viruses for a number of years now, and the earliest I found, but I didn't look very hard, but the earliest I found was a report from 2003 where the CDC was patenting SARS. And the official reason why do they do this, they say it is because private companies are attempting to patent these viruses, which would obviously, in the event of an epidemic or pandemic, would be extremely problematic because you would then need to license the virus itself in order to do research on it. Mm. So the CDC is saying we're going to patent these viruses in order to make them part of the public domain. And so far, at any rate, that's what they've been doing. They haven't been charging researchers for use of these patents. So not exactly the type of scare scenario that some in the alternative media have made it out to be. And furthermore, the specific strain of Ebola that the CDC has the patent on that people are pointing to is not the strain of Ebola that is the current outbreak. So a couple of things that kind of temper our criticism on those regards.
Okay, very good. Maybe not as sinister as we previously thought, although you did joke yourself, the Center for Disease Creation, and we all are very suspicious of what's going on. I do find it absolutely insane that they imported two Ebola patients into the country. Okay, so we've covered MH17 and Ebola. The last thing on my agenda for you was to ask you about your thoughts about what's happening in Ferguson, Missouri. What is your take on these militarized police as you look on from the sunny climes of Japan, as you like to say?
Well, that is interesting because obviously I think I'm doubly removed from this situation. I mean, I'm not American in the first place. I'm Canadian. And secondly, here I am in Japan where I've been for the last 10 years. So I think I really am doubly removed from what's going on there. So I certainly don't claim to comment on the sort of culture there in the United States that that has led to the sort of bubbling over of these tensions. But in terms of the buildup of the police state itself, as my friend Brock West of AP Perspective tweeted out the other day, I don't know why people are so surprised at the militarization that the police are demonstrating right now, because I thought we'd established that years ago. And I've certainly been watching this from such things as the G20 back in, I believe it was Pittsburgh a few years ago, where they unleashed the LRAD sound cannons and the creepy images of police, basically SWAT police in black death gear, coming along in the streets with their loudspeakers saying, "This is now an unlawful assembly, clear out or you will be arrested." All of these, I mean, scenes that would be out of some sort of nightmare science fiction movie just a couple of decades ago are now taking place on the streets of the United States. So I certainly see this as part and parcel of a sort of an agenda of militarization of the police that's been happening for a very long time. And it is absolutely disgusting and horrifying to see this taking place and to see this being done and rolled out and the public again being conditioned to accept this because, well, we can't have looting, so we might as well have basically military police with tear gas stopping even press from reporting on things like this. Again, it's just ludicrous on its face, but this is all part and parcel of everything that we've been talking about, the decline of the American empire and the coming economic collapse. And the sort of decline of American power throughout the world. I think that's all part and parcel of the fact that America is now becoming this lockdown police state, and they're sort of stepping out from the shadows in terms of the overt control of the American society. And I think we're likely to see more of these types of events spilling over as that economic decline continues to happen, even if it isn't an overnight collapse scenario. Just the general lessening of the standard of living in the United States is going to have these types of effects more and more often. And again, I think the public is just being prepped to accept the police are basically going to be these vampiric military SWAT death wraiths from something like out of a fantasy movie. And unfortunately, I don't see a way out of that in terms of direct confrontation between the public and the police, because unfortunately the government tends to have the upper hand technologically speaking in these situations. I think the real change is going to happen in the consciousness. And we've seen that in recent years in some of the protests that were taking place in Europe, where the police in Spain and other places did cross the line and did join the protesters. It can happen. It has happened before many times throughout history. These people are not automatons. So I think we have to really reach out to people in the police and military as potential allies of the American people. Because again, these aren't robots, at least at this point. The drone armies haven't been released yet. So I think we have to reach out to the humanity of these people and get them to see that they are the targets of this system every bit as much as the average person in the United States.
Yeah, agreed. And if there's good news, it's that we can see resistance to this militarized police force in Ferguson. We see people standing up. We see people speaking out. We see very articulate people at these press conferences, actually, wondering where the justice is and why there hasn't been an indictment against the police officer who executed the man who was shot 8 times. And so we know the Pentagon militarized the Ferguson police force. It's documented. And now I guess the best way to prove that you have a tyrannical government is to get them to act like it. And that's what they're doing. And they're being met with peaceful resistance, which I think is the answer. And it certainly is good news, if there's any good news coming out of Ferguson, Missouri. I know I have to let you go. One last question, and it's this. Fukushima. It scares the heck out of me, and I'm nowhere near it. Does it scare the heck out of you, and could you see yourself having to evacuate Japan at any point in the future?
Well, I mean, obviously, it could. There could be the need for evacuation for any number of reasons, for any number of nuclear reactors throughout the country, let alone Fukushima. But certainly at this point, obviously, I'm still living here with my family, so I don't think it's quite the world-ending type of scenario that some have posited it as being. Although it certainly is a cause of concern, and right now, I mean, the situation as it exists is still a daily struggle at the site to contain the even. Just the water that they're furiously pumping in to keep the situation under quote-unquote control obviously is not any type of control, because that contaminated water is being stored on site in all of these tanks that themselves are leaking. It's disaster upon disaster. So obviously, I mean, that region of Japan is very much in a sad state, and that creates all sorts of other problems. Like, for example, just as one particular example, there's a large fast food chain here in Japan that a year and a half ago or so announced that they were going to be sourcing all of their rice from Fukushima from now on to support the Fukushima region and the farmers of that region. So again, there are very worrying things that happen here. And I think if for people who are in Japan, I think they have to be very careful where they're sourcing their food from and things of that nature, as myself and my family are part of a green cooperative that sources local organic non-GMO foods that they radiation test. So it is possible, I think, to at least be wary of the things that are going on here. And of course, we have to keep abreast of what's happening with the site and the melted down cores that they still don't know where they are, because they can't even get into the reactors to form any sort of survey of the corium. And to figure out how it's lying and where it's lying. They continue to release bits and pieces and drips and drabs over the course of years, which I think is part of, again, of the plan. I think just like in the early days, they knew within 24 hours that they had a meltdown on their hands, but they've neglected to tell the public that for the course of months. I think they probably know more about what's happening at the site than they're letting on. And the latest is that they're saying that the Reactor 3 is in a worse situation than they believed originally, with all of the core having melted down to the bottom of the containment vessel. So again, we have to be very wary about what's happening there. But having said that, I think that for people in the United States and Canada on the West Coast there that are concerned about the effects of Fukushima, I think that they have to also be very careful about what information they're taking on board with that. And there is a citizen-led initiative that's taking place right now called Inform, and I have a link to that up on my Fukushima website, fukushimaupdate.com, that are taking samples on the west coast of the United States and in Canada's far north and other places right now that are, it's crowdsourced and crowdfunded, and this citizen initiative is sampling for looking for signs of Fukushima radiation. The Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute has already done some sampling on the West Coast and found no sign of Fukushima radiation on the West Coast. I think that there is a lot of hype that's going on in the alternative media as well surrounding this issue. And I wonder to the extent to which the American nuclear industry benefits from the type of hype that's surrounding Fukushima in the United States right now, meaning that that people don't pay attention to what's happening literally in their own backyards. For example, just earlier this year at the Hanford site in Washington State, just miles from the Columbia River, the most contaminated site in the United States was having its own leak problems. And under tank AY-102, they found, I think, 800,000 count levels of radioactivity with high dose rates that required workers to limit their time in the area in order to not exceed their lifetime recommended dose of radiation. And there was great concern about the leaks that were taking place there. The average American hasn't heard anything about that in the media, despite the fact that this was taking place just a short time ago in a site that, again, was just miles away from the Columbia River. And why is that? I mean, why are none of these nuclear issues in the United States being reported on anymore? And I think that this might, in fact, play into the nuclear industry's hands in America, that people are not looking in their own backyard for some of the problems that are demonstrably there.
Yeah, I appreciate your perspective on that. I'm going to let you go in a second. I want to thank you for that, because it gets real scary to see even the mainstream media reporting about the unprecedented die-off of starfish and other sea life on the West Coast. And of course, they never mention Fukushima radiation. So for those of us who are informed, we immediately fear that that's exactly what it is. Could you shout out your Fukushima site, your website again there for people to visit and learn about your research and intelligence on Fukushima?
FukushimaUpdate.com, FukushimaUpdate.com. That's all one word. It's linked on CorbettReport.com, so you can find a link there. And on the starfish wasting syndrome specifically, you can find a post up on there, three reasons why Fukushima radiation has nothing to do with starfish wasting syndrome, primarily because the phenomenon was documented in a study that was published in 2009, 2 years before Fukushima even took place. So again, I think a lot of people are finding and discovering all of these problems in the Pacific Ocean that may or may not be linkable to Fukushima, but they are taking that stretch even when it's not really supported by the evidence. So it is important to keep abreast of these various things that are happening. Again, I don't want to dissuade people from doing research, but I think we have to be, again, careful about what types of claims are being made here.
Well, well said. The evidence of bad things being done, though, by bad people is certainly made clear in your documentary, Century of Enslavement, The History of the Federal Reserve. And I sure hope people will go to CorbettReport.com and buy a DVD copy for themselves, friends, family, get the word out, and certainly do watch it at least for free at the Corbett Report YouTube channel. Our guest has been my new friend and somebody I've held in high esteem for a very long time, James Corbett. James, I can't thank you enough for all your time.
Thank you so much for having me on, Sean. As I say, I do appreciate your work, so thank you for doing what you do.
My pleasure. And guys, thanks so much for taking the time to listen and share this interview with others. We wouldn't be doing it without your support and help. Give us a like if you liked it. Share it with those you love. And do visit us at sgtreport.com for real truth, real news 24/7. And check out thecorbettreport.com for more real news from the one and only James Corbett. Thanks, you guys. Have a great week. Thank you, James.
Thank you, Sean.
Bye-bye.
Take care.